The Life and Work of Andrew Wyeth. Tonight on PBS stations, including Maine Public Television, American Masters debuts its documentary film about the painter Andrew Wyeth, who spent much of his life working in Maine. During his lifetime, Wyeth's work was wildly popular and also controversial. He is perhaps best known for his portrait of Christina Olson and her home in Cushing, Christina's World. 70 years after Wyeth painted that scene, thousands of visitors each year make a pilgrimage of sorts to experience the house and property. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we explore the life and work of Andrew Wyeth with people who knew him. What does the work of Andrew Wyeth mean to you? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Andrew Wyeth's paintings are among the most recognized and best loved of any American painter. Tonight, a PBS documentary on Wyeth's life and legacy debuts at 10, and you can see it on Maine Public Television. Today on Maine Calling, we are going to learn more about this influential artist. Joining me in the studio, Elliot Bostwick Davis. She is chair of the Americas Department at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Chris Crossman is a trustee of the Wyeth Foundation for American Art and former director of the Farnsworth Museum. And Peter Ralston is a photographer and Wyeth family friend. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the work and life of Andrew Wyeth? Do you have a favorite Wyeth painting? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. And you know, Peter, I think I want to start with you because you knew Andrew Wyeth from the time you were a boy, didn't you?
In 1957, my parents bought a place in Chatsworth, Pennsylvania. The next year, Andy and Betsy bought the other part of that property. So since I was eight, right through.
What were they like when you were a boy? How did they engage with you?
Well, my brothers and I were feral little children. And would run loose on their property. I started playing on their islands in the Brandywine River. And truth be told, I had a wicked crush on Betsy, you know, from the time I was at 8 years of age. They were so giving. The house was open.
Is the reason you are in Maine because of the Wyeths?
Yeah. I mean, growing up with them, we didn't summer in Maine. They'd come back from Port Clyde and the paintings would appear on the walls of the house. They'd come out of the Jeep, and I grew up seeing these paintings. Maine to me was an amazing exotic place, as far away and as exotic as Africa or China. And then in '78, after years of sort of traveling as a photojournalist, at dinner one night in Chatsford, it was not an invitation; it was an edict. You, with finger pointed from Betsy, are coming to Maine this summer and spending the summer with us.
Oh, my goodness. So and how old were you?
I was then 28. And the cool part of it was all of a sudden I'm driving around with Andy in the Jeep and Betsy in the boat, meeting the people that I had grown up hearing these stories about and seeing the landscapes, the seascapes, and the people. It was an extraordinary introduction. And they knew exactly what they were doing bringing me here. They played me. and it took, and I've never left.
So you're an artist as well. You're a photographer, well-known photographer. Was your decision to be a photographer, and do you think your eye was influenced by the Wyeths?
Well, they were a huge influence. I mean, for me, a lot of it was growing up. We didn't have glowing screens. We barely had TV at that point, much less iPads and phones and all that business. This enormous visual influence next door, it was so exotic. It was so exciting. So I always wanted to be a photographer. Life magazine was fascinating, National Geographic. But this nuclear plant of creativity next door, I absorbed it.
Hmm.
God forbid I suggest that, you know, I've tried to imitate Andy or, you know, any of that. But it was a huge influence, as much as any other photographer, as much as any other artist.
Oh, wow. I want to bring Elliot and Chris, you into the conversation. Chris, when did you first meet Andrew Wyeth? Do you remember?
It was going back to the first probably week or two I arrived here in Maine. And our initial exhibition, which had been planned way before.
And when you say our, you were the director of the Farnsworth Museum.
So sorry. Yeah, yeah. It was 1988, so, you know, relatively late in Andrew's career. But we had on the books an exhibition of Andrew's work that we had to install. And that was my real first introduction to Andrew's work. Betsy was a presence that I was not prepared for.
Few are.
I too became immediately smitten with her and actually probably knew her better than I knew Andrew. Andrew never stopped painting. He was sort of, you know, with John McCain's funeral, they compared him to a shark. Well, Andrew was the shark of the art world. He never stopped painting or doing work. And, you know, after 5 o'clock, he would come home and have a drink and sit down with Betsy or, you know, Jamie if he was in the neighborhood and things of that sort. But in any case, I was stunned by this work. I had spent most of my career up to that point at a museum that specialized in abstract painting, the Albright Knox in Buffalo. And it was abstract painting of the 1950s that was really the core of their collection. So here's this artist who really came to the forefront in the late 40s and early 50s doing nothing like Jackson Pollock or Mark Rothko or Franz Klein. Or at least that was the impression I heard or I had. But in truth, he fit right in with those folks. He was every bit as serious and important and an artist who really deserved not only my full attention, but I thought the public were right. The critics were wrong, as they usually are. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, we were off and running.
And I want to talk about that a little bit in this program. And the film that will air tonight also talks about this sort of tension between what the public thought and what the critics thought throughout Andrew Wyeth's life. But, Chris, you're talking about installing that show. So Andrew Wyeth was not supervising where his paintings would hang.
No, he was not. But what was a presence was Betsy. She came in and sort of gave it a quick eyeball and, you know, nodded that it was okay. You know, it could be better. But, you know, we survived that initial encounter. And I, too, grew very fond of her. And as is noted in the film, I think rightly, Betsy's importance to his career is critical. It's essential. It was stated in the film that he would not have been the artist that he became without Betsy. And there are lots of reasons for that and things that we could talk about, but it is absolutely the truth.
Elliot Bostwick Davis, we first met when you curated the Jamie Wyeth show at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Was that your first experience with the Wyeth family, or did you know Andrew as well?
I did know Andrew primarily because I had grown up in New York City, but in the summers we were in Shelburne, Vermont. So the painting Soaring was something that I knew from, I always think of it as even before I could speak. I didn't really ever think they were turkey buzzards. I always believed they were eagles. But I knew it was a painting about flying, and I just loved it. It was in a room that had the painting at the far end. It was very dramatic. It had a low ceiling. And so it was something that, you know, is one of those touchstones with a lot of works of art that you can enjoy over time. Mm. But so, I got to know him really through the Jamie Wyeth Project in backing into it. I purposely didn't read about Andrew's bibliography. I never met Andrew in person, but I really started with N.C. Wyeth's letters that Betsy had compiled because I really wanted to begin at the beginning and not be colored by so much of the discussion around Andrew's work that had come from both sides if I was assessing Jamie. So I really put that off for a very long time. And then, of course, I came to it at the end.
What I'm interested in from the sort of perspective of a curator, Do you believe, Elliot, that Andrew Wyeth's reputation, his importance in the art world, has changed in the years since his death, the way that people in your world perceive of Wyeth's work?
I do think that there's a whole new generation really beginning to assess him freshly. I think that there are many young scholars that are quite interested in his work and actually install it in the Metropolitan, in fact, which is not some place. I had worked there for 10 years before I came to the Museum of Fine Arts. And I never in my years of being there for a decade did I remember seeing an Andrew Wyeth in the galleries. But right now, the curators of 20th Century, Randy Griffey, there's a wonderful installation with Wyeth's portrait right next to Paul Cadmus, Seven Deadly Sins, and they're all in tempera. So in a very mid-century period of thinking about an old master material, I think is quite modern and how these artists are coming at it. They even included Fidelma Cadmus's work and along with her brother Paul Cadmus. So it's really interesting to see others assessing this work freshly, I think.
All right, we're talking about Andrew Wyeth. A film about Andrew Wyeth premieres on PBS tonight at 10. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, and post to our Facebook page. Chris, earlier you were talking about the critics versus the public. And I remember, I mean, throughout my lifetime, people would talk about Andrew Wyeth as a realist painter. They'd talk about his technical skills, but say that he was out of touch. Sometimes said he was, you know, his paintings were too sentimental. But now we're looking at him as a true modernist. Can you talk about why the evaluation is changing? And maybe did the public realize this all along?
That's a huge question, and
we
can spend the rest of the day talking about that. Critics, as I like to say, are all, you know, the ones who were the most vehemently opposed to Andrew's work have passed away for the most part. And Elliot is absolutely right. There's a younger generation. And they're not critics, they're scholars. They're people who look at these things very closely. I will say that the one thing that has happened, I think, in recent years is that museums have begun to put the Wyeth paintings out that they own, formerly in the storeroom. Once you have seen an original painting by Andrew or Jamie, for that matter, it changes your perspective. You begin to realize that it was way beyond just master craftsmanship. There's substance behind not all of the paintings, but the ones that we find in the museum collection. So what's happened is that you can actually see them nowadays. You can see them at the Farnsworth or at the Portland Museum or at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and even now, I guess, at the Met. And, of course, Christina's world is at the Museum of Modern Art, and it's usually up, although they have in the past put it in the context of works that you might expect, but now I think there's a movement to look at him in light of the artists who were his peers, the Pollocks and the Rothkos and Cadmus for that matter, and people of that period. So it's a kind of a sea change that has happened, and the public in the visual arts, at least, I think the public gets it right more often than the critics, especially with the living artist. It's something that is changing with perhaps just education and the presence of museums around the world that people are flocking to and have been.
Peter, you want to jump in?
Well, I always do. Of course, Chris is spot on with this. I once shared with Andy an Arabic proverb that I heard, and I thought this so applies to all these critics, you know, yap, you know, nipping at his heels. The proverb being, the jackals may nip and yap, and yet the stately caravan goes on. And that was Andy. I mean, there were those who were chewing away at him, but he stayed so true to his vision. I mean, he did exactly what he wanted to do, and boy, did he do it well.
Why do you think he was able to do that, stay so true to his vision?
Mirroring what Chris had to say. A lot of it I would lay right at Betsy's feet. You know, from get-go, You know, NC thought Andy could make a great career as an illustrator, as NC himself had done. But it was Betsy who said, you know, do your thing. I mean, you know, paint what you know, paint what you love, go deep. And that's what he did. And he never came off that heading, ever. And yeah, I mean, a lot of the critics hated it. Some of them recanted at the end, you know, at the end of their careers. Robert Hughes mm-hmm. came around and sort of ate back a lot of the, you know, sort of vitriol he had poured on Andy earlier. But I think the public, if you will, had no skin in the game. They didn't have to, you know, the larger public didn't have to prove themselves intellectually or in any other way. They responded. And I think they're, even if the magic realism, if there weren't terms that were understood, people could relate to it.
Elliot?
I just was thinking about what a remarkable family, you know, beginning with NC and the five children. I think often people forget that his two older sisters were artists themselves. And I do think Andrew mm-hmm. Wyeth would have been a very different painter if those two siblings had not actually worked so closely with their father and been trained by their mm-hmm. father, Henriette and Carolyn. So I do think it's a fascinating story to see how the creative spark plays out. And I know that's mm-hmm. talked about a lot, but I think we've only barely begun to think about that more broadly. And I do think that's how he was able to focus in on his own vision, given this great opportunity that his father and family offered him.
I just add to that. Totally correct. Andrew Wyeth, in his own way, was a storyteller. He inherited that from his father and artists that he admired as he was growing up and learning the trade. But he was the kind of storyteller that put you in the middle of the story, didn't tell you what happened before, didn't really tell you what was going to happen next. It was this open-endedness of his paintings that I think is what does resonate with people. They can make their own associations. They can make up their own stories. There's a commonality of what he was painting and how he was painting it that just simply resonates with people. They find things of their own lives, their own associations with the paintings that they're looking at, I think, as much as anything else.
Amen. I watched the film again last night, it's the second time I've seen it. It's a terrific film. I learned things in it. And one loves that. The thing that I took away last night that really hit me last night, Chris, I think it speaks to exactly what you're saying and what we're all saying. It was a clip of Andy speaking. Somebody was interviewing Andy, and I don't think I had seen this one before. But he was asked, so what is painting to you? And his answer was, my painting is truth. And then he paused. I could see him going off thinking. It's truth and memory. Mm. And I think people sense, like dogs sense fear, and you know, we all sense, have different radar. I think people really sensed truth and memory. And of course, Andy's secret sauce, if you will, is stirring a little magic to it all. You know, there's incredible imagination. I mean, my God, he was the son of N.C. Wyeth, you know, who was nothing but imagination, swashbuckling and all this. And that's who Andy was, and that's what came out of him.
We have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're discussing Andrew Wyeth. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Lincoln Home in Newcastle, committed to providing gracious retirement living on the Damariscotta River. Learn more at lincoln-home.org. An evergreen home performance offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, presenting the Common Ground Country Fair, September 21st through 23rd. Details at mofca.org.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we'll talk with a family, a mother, a father, and three kids, trying to keep things together after the mother is deported to Honduras.
I taught her how to use the hoverboard, and then she actually wanted me to send her the hoverboard. But
Honduras?
Yeah. And I was like, are you crazy? He'll kill you for that.
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Join us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock and Sunday night at 11 here on Maine Public Radio. The new season of Poldark on Masterpiece starts on September 30th on Maine Public Television, and we're holding a couple of sneak preview advance screenings with the final episode of Season 3 and the new first episode of Season 4. The first screening is at the Grand in Ellsworth this Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. Next will be the Lincoln Theater in Damariscotta on Friday afternoon, September 14th at 2 p.m. And the third is at Bayside Bowl in Portland on Thursday evening, September 27th at 7 p.m. Complete information is at mainepublic.org. Click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about the American painter Andrew Wyeth. Joining me in the studio, Chris Crossman, who is a trustee with the Wyeth Foundation for American Art and former director of the Farnsworth Museum. Peter Ralston is here. He's a photographer and a close Wyeth family friend. And Elliot Bostwick Davis is chair of the Americas Department at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. We invite you to join the conversation. What do Andrew Wyeth's works mean to you? Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, we were talking about the imagination that came with being N.C. Wyeth's son. And their home, and Jamie Wyeth has talked about this, was filled with costumes and props and dolls, and it was not your typical house.
Oh, no. I mean, my introduction to the Wyeths, Betsy was this beautiful, dark woman who stayed and lived in this mill. Andy was a strange guy. He wasn't like our fathers. I mean, he'd go off and paint, drive around in the Jeep, get stuck. Farmers would have to pull him out. Very different lifestyle. But the homes were filled with props, and yet Spartan. Mm. Betsy, their homes in which they actually lived were almost Spartan, beautiful early American pieces, but very, very spare, almost like his temperas, like his paintings. It was spare.
And yet I think, you know, it's so interesting seeing his studio. You can visit with the Brandywine River Museum and how bare the studio itself is, except that it had all the jars of pigments along the windowsill. So there are all the original pigments that you would then mix up to create the tempera. And they just look beautiful with the light coming through them on the windowsill. But it's otherwise just tacked up drawings and his place to work is his easel, and that's about it.
And let me talk about that. We keep using the phrase tempera, and this is the kind of paint he used, which is a paint that is not very forgiving, is it, Chris?
No, but it's a technique that really comes out of the Renaissance, the Italian Renaissance, and it's the way Andrew used it, which was pretty much the way the Renaissance artists used it, was to build up layers of paint. Even more so than many of the Renaissance painters, I think. And it is not forgiving, but it does allow you to really think about what you're doing and to plan as best you can with the painting. I'm sure there were changes.
The one main ingredient, the binder, is the egg yolk that gives it an incredible durability and also an incredible luminosity that I think he loved. So it turns out, I guess, early on he certainly loved watercolor, his first show that sold out early on, but as a young man. But I think it's interesting that he, you know, like so many, would not use the medium of his father, who was really NC working so much in oil. Of course, Jamie works a lot in oil and all kinds of combined media. But his father was for this very, at the mid-century, many of these modernists, Cadmus and Tooker and Wyeth and others were really working into all kinds of encaustics and temperas and really rehabilitating these techniques that had been around since some of them ancient Egypt.
I'd just like to mention something. We were talking about the austerity of the homes, and that was Betsy as much as anything. Mm-hmm. But it's also important to understand that Betsy was the daughter of a rotogravure editor, photo editor at the Buffalo News. And she used to go with her father into the newsroom, and he would explain to her why he would choose certain photographs. And she became really a visual editor to some extent, of her husband's work. I'm not sure that she directly intervened, you know, in the midst of a painting. Probably not. It was only lending him and her eye, which was in those days, I think, when they were first married, was very much attuned to not having him become an illustrator. The anecdote was banished from his work, and there's a famous story of a painting that Andrew had done, very proud of it. It was a large-scale tempera of a man walking in a field, and he showed it to his father, and his father said, that's all well and good, but the man needs a gun and a dog. And he reported that back to Betsy, and they had just been married. It was like literally days or weeks. And she said, I'll leave you if you put a gun or a dog into that painting.
Turkey Cove.
Turkey Cove.
The name of it. Oh, yeah. I think his father thought he wouldn't be able to support himself without that ability to tell the story that the public could understand. But, Peter, you mentioned his really following his own vision. And I think that's really the great artists are really able to do that, to put everything aside and really focus in on what it is they have to say as an aesthetic voice.
We'll go to Sheila, who's calling from Camden. Hi, Sheila. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling in. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
I have what I believe are the first two things that Andrew ever sold. He sold them to my grandmother in Chester County, PA, when he was 13. I have the check for $13.
Oh, my gosh.
That my grandmother made out to Andy. Huh. And just to tell a little bit about him, a few years before he died, I ran into him at the Farnsworth Museum and began to talk about that transaction with him. And he just wanted to talk about my grandmother, which I thought was very, very Andy. He didn't want to talk about himself particularly, but he certainly remembered those two trees.
Sheila, these works that Andrew sold when he was 13 years old, are they paintings? And what is the subject matter?
They're drawings. They're
drawings.
Two of them. They're drawings, and each one has a single tree in.
Hmm.
Almost like a sketch.
Nice.
God, I'd love to see them.
Yeah. I would, too. That sounds wonderful. You know, it is true that Andrew was one of the most personable artists I've ever met.
Oh.
He couldn't be friendlier or nicer. He wanted to be left alone while he was painting and while he was working. But if you met him on the street in Rockland, which was not unusual, he would be glad to spend, you know, half an hour talking to you and asking about your family and what have you. So there is that part of him. And actually, one of the things in the film that I think you don't really get directly is that he had this tremendous sense of humor. And we could talk about that as well. But anyway, what a wonderful thing to have from your family.
Peter, when Chris said that, you rolled your eyes. Do you have something you can share on the radio about Andrew's sense of humor?
Being on the radio.
On the radio.
Watch myself here. No, but Andy was full of hell. He really had a great time in life. He was so full of life. I mean, the world, I think, sometimes think of Andy as, you know, some Amishman tucked away and, you know, cloistered from the world. I mean, they lived a very simple life in some ways, very, very, very sophisticated in a lot of ways. They were very learned people. I mean, Andy didn't go to school. You know, he studied at, you know, the feet of his father and others in the family. Lots of gusto, lots of life, wicked sense of humor. And trying to think of a single story, my God, it's...
Well, just tell them about Dr. Sin, the painting that he did for Betsy.
Well, so Betsy in 1978 bought an island off the coast, and on it was a bell tower. Well, Andy had, I mean, again, the fascination with historical figures and swashbuckling stories and so forth, I mean, really drove his life. I mean, his life was sort of an extension of playing with those toy soldiers. So he had a fascination with Admiral Lord Nelson and the affair that Nelson had with Lady Hamilton. And Betsy saw herself as Lady Hamilton. Andy was Lord Nelson. So in the bell tower on this particular island off the coast, Betsy had it done up as Nelson's stateroom aboard HMS Victory, complete with cannon and everything, and every once in a while we'd fire the cannons off and once knocked a very expensive antique to the floor, which upset Betsy. Anyway, Andy one summer was not, I think he was contemplating his mortality, it never being far, I think, ultimately mortality from Andy's mind. And he had been, the question of a self-portrait had risen. So he decided to paint himself as a naval officer, perhaps Nelson, inside the bell tower with a parquet floor that was Nelson's, as a skeleton. It's a Dr. Syn, S-Y-N. I could go on and on about this particular story. I hope your listeners will Google that, Wyeth Dr. Syn, and see the painting, this self-portrait
of
as
himself
a skeleton. Yeah, with the cannon in the background, the whole bit.
But what I always think of when I see that painting is that his father had him actually draw the skeleton, which is a standard practice for many artists and many art schools. And yet then he said to Andy, purportedly, all right, now draw it without looking at it.
Yeah.
So, of course, he could. I know that particular painting is based on his own, supposedly his own X-ray or something like that. But nonetheless, he certainly could have drawn a skeleton from memory, to your point earlier about how much how much training really he had that he was able to do that.
Well, it was a birthday gift for Betsy. She had given him the bell tower. This was his riposte.
Yeah.
He wanted to sort of, humorously match her wit and interest in history, I guess. I don't know.
So relative to that one painting, and this, my God, we could do these stories for weeks, I have a feeling. But on that particular painting, we were on his son Nicky's boat one day, and we all went down to over to Damerscove Island. And I remember Andy had his water. He always had a pencil he always had paper and pencil handy, and usually there were paints, watercolors not far away. And he was doing some watercoloring on Damerscove. And on the way back, we went by Seguin Island, it was before that. And there's a First Order lighthouse on the top of Seguin, this great, huge granite dome, and then this big, hulking lighthouse. And Andy started sketching it, the island with the lighthouse on top. And then he morphed. I've never told this before. He morphed the top of the dome on Seguin into a skull. And it was that summer, it was right after that he started working on Dr. Syn.
Mm.
And he was always picking
working
up these
things
little
out.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, things would come into his imagination. He saw the top of the Seguin light and just quickly did a skull.
Mm. Wow.
He gave me that drawing.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Lucky you.
Yeah.
Many, many of his works have these personal associations that... you were talking about the skull and the dome of the lighthouse. There's another painting called The Duel, and it's kind of a portrait in absentia of his good friend from childhood, Walt Anderson, who is a fisherman. Walt's not in the painting. It's just this big granite hulking stone, and then a kind of a weathered oar is propped up against it.
Mm.
But even that stone, you begin to look at that in terms of a portrait, it becomes the forehead of Walt. Yeah, maybe that's my own imagination, but that's why those paintings are just so rich. When you start looking at them and you start thinking about your own life or people you've known or other things that you can bring to bear on what the artist might have been thinking, not what he was thinking, but what he might have been thinking.
We're going to go to Chris, who's calling from South Thomaston. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi there. What a great show. Thank you for picking me up. My mother, who was 85 when she died a few years ago, her aunt and uncle lived out in Port Clyde. And when we visited them one summer, she started to talk with Aunt Jenny about Andrew Wyeth. And I was very confused because I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. And, I knew NC from the museum and everything. But I was saying, wait a minute, no, he's down there, not up here. And my Aunt Jenny, my mother's Aunt Jenny, said, oh, that boy Andrew, he used to come around here all the time when he was a boy. And he would sit here and have cookies. And, he didn't like the painting over my fireplace. So he said, I'll paint you a painting over your fireplace. And Jenny said, well, what would it be? And he said, well, that'll be a surprise. And she said, I don't like surprises, so I don't want you to do it. So she never got it. And when she was telling me the story, she went, I probably should have let him do it.
That's a great story, Chris. Thanks so much for sharing. I'm going to go to a Facebook post. This is Lauren. She writes, I posed for Andrew Wyeth in 1999. He would ask me questions about myself during my time posing, but he would also go into a stream of consciousness storytelling about what he saw as he was painting, what he saw in me. I felt and feel that his portraits, although they look like the sitter, really are images of characters in his imagination. I'm sure Chris or Peter can talk about his love of film.
Oh, sure. Who wants to?
Well, yes, he loved film. I mean, there's one in particular that has been talked about at great length by historians and others, and Andrew himself was greatly influenced, apparently, by a film by King Vidor called The Big Parade, and it was a early film that depicted the First World War, which kind of fit into, he was born in 1918, so the First World War was kind of a fact of his early childhood and the toy soldiers and what have you. I'm not sure how it fits into all of the portraits that he did. He only painted portraits of people that he knew and was interested in, more from a personality standpoint than from their looks, I think. And if this is the Lauren, I think it is, he was probably just fascinated by her profession, her life in Maine, and wanted to kind of probe that a little bit visually. There's certainly a case to be made that there are other artists other associations that could be brought to bear on those portraits. But anyway, yeah, film is a big deal for them.
We're going to take another quick break. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're discussing Andrew Wyeth. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do New England Cancer Specialists. 50 years of working toward better outcomes for Maine patients. Learn more at newenglandcancerspecialist.org. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communications systems. NorrisInc.com.
A year after a violent and racially charged incident in New Hampshire, we'll hear from two young men about what it's like growing up black in a town that's mostly white.
It's very difficult to learn when you're more worried about your skin color versus like your schoolwork.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll also sit in on a new play that explores race and hopes to make its audience uncomfortable.
Because that cringiness and that like discomfort is what black people experience 90% of the day.
Please join us.
Coming up shortly at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public invites you to the 14th Annual Camden International Film Festival, which runs this year from Thursday, September 13th through Sunday, the 16th. The Camden International Film Festival is widely recognized as a top documentary film festival, and Maine Public members can save 10% on tickets. For more information about the 2018 Camden International Film Festival and the Maine Public member discount, go to mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, today on the program all about painter Andrew Wyeth. Joining us today, Peter Ralston, who's a photographer and Wyeth family friend. Elliot Bostwick Davis is with Boston's Museum of Fine Arts, and Chris Crossman is with the Wyeth Foundation for American Art. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Peter, when folks see the film tonight about Andrew Wyeth, or even watch the trailer, they're going to see a photograph that you took of Andrew Wyeth front and center. Tell us about that photograph. How did you come to take that portrait?
Well, I had been asked to photograph Andy for the cover of the authorized biography, Dick Merriman's book, Secret Life. And for that, we wanted to get what we all called the look. If Andy saw something out in the course of a day that really interested him, he'd squint down. He'd squint like a surgeon about to make an important incision. He was really intense. So I got that image, but the one that leads the film and titled In His Eyes came within 30 seconds of that. And I really love it because I like it much more than the cover of the book. It's just the two of us looking at each other, and it was just a terrific moment. So I made up a print of that to give Andy and Betsy. I was over at their house for drinks and finally gave
this is kind of a little bit of a theme, isn't it? Over at their house for drinks.
Oh, yeah. Five, I mean, they like their vodka tonic.
Sorry to interrupt the story, but
go on. That was integral. So as a young man, Andy, when we were talking, and Andy said, you know, portraits, as Chris, you said, Andy was a storyteller. And the story of his life with memory and magic stirred in. I remember Andy as a young man, Andy saying, well, every portrait is the story of that person. Every line is a chapter, and the deep creases are whole chapter, you know.
Every line is a story.
Every story and every crease is a chapter like that. So Andy, you know, I made that photograph of Andy in his 80s, and it's a good portrait. And when I turned it around and gave it to him, his reaction, the master of the one hair brush and the storytelling, goes, my God, when did this happen to me? I look like the old man in the mountain.
So it was okay for other people to look that way.
He liked it.
Oh.
He liked it. And he actually, he liked that portrait a lot.
Oh, that's great. And how did it feel for you, for him to like it so much?
Well, if Andy liked something that you had done, I mean, really liked it, I mean, does it get any better? These were tough people. These were not, they were not people to say, oh, that's interesting, or that's nice, or that's cute. No, if they cared in amongst themselves, I mean, they were tough, Chris. We all know.
I didn't know.
They were tough. So if Andy and Betsy really like something, it was what an honor.
Yeah, or God. If they didn't like something, you knew.
Ooh.
It.
Yeah.
I remember, it's probably not a story I should broadcast, but I will anyway. But I got this very, very kind of, today we would call it a hot letter from Betsy, actually. It was about something I had said.
Thank God Betsy never discovered tweeting.
Yes. Well, she would never have had anything to do with it in the first place. She would write it out in these very closely spaced, you know, this penmanship that she had from her time as a girl. But anyway, got this letter, and I knew I had to jump in the car and get down to Chaz Ford and explain what I had done or why or what have you. And it all worked out in the end, but they let you know how they felt, and particularly Betsy, I think, was so protective and concerned about her husband and his welfare and his well-being. I mean, that was what it was all about.
Chris, we're talking here about we've spoken a lot about Betsy and about N.C. Wyeth, but you know we can't forget that Andrew Wyeth's son is Jamie Wyeth, who is an astonishing artist of his own. And you want to share something about something Jamie said about his dad?
Well, I just, when Andrew passed away, there was a very short kind of statement by Jamie Wyeth that I think appeared in Time magazine. Maybe it was Newsweek. I can't remember. And I just thought it was the truest thing that has ever been said or written about what Andrew Wyeth's work was about. And I'll just quote it. Jamie said, quote, his world was a magically airless, crystal-lit microcosm of which he was the sole inhabitant, and his paintings will remain, by his own design, forever elusive. And I think that's absolutely on the mark. You can interpret these things till the cows come home. You could talk about what Andy himself might have been thinking about these things. But in the end, they're mysterious. Peter mentioned it. I mean, there's a sense of magic and certainly a sense of wonder that he never relinquished from childhood that is embedded in almost every one of his paintings. And I think that's what made his work so extraordinary, so special, and what links him back, you know, to the Renaissance masters and to his own time as well.
Elliot, as we look back, where is Andrew Wyeth's place in art history?
Well, he certainly has a place in art history as a great master, but I think he will constantly be reevaluated over many, many generations. And I think what for me is so interesting about his work is that he not only has, we've talked about his own distinctive vision of Maine and Chaz Ford, but he manages to, in a very American way, he builds in folk art, the old masters. He obviously admired someone like Albrecht Dürer. I've always loved his, he loved the little image of Dürer's rabbit. Mm. And then when he paints, rarely paints children, but when he does paint his own children and he paints Jamie, he paints him as a young boy, you know, clutching his knees as though he's a little, you know, Dürer hare in the midst of this hillside of Chad's Ford, wearing a coonskin cap that I guess he loved. So, you know, that's sort of a thing that you're able to make something your own and yet have all of these rich resonances. And I do think we'll continue for many generations ahead to appreciate his, not just his vision, but his remarkable ability to continue to explore a theme until he gets it to exactly where he wants it. He might go through, you know, 20 or more studies, and we see this often in his work where the studies survive, and he'll study a theme like the night hauling picture of Walt Anderson hauling a trap out of Port Clyde at night, which he shouldn't have been doing. It was illegal. But but he'll do that through 21 studies and look at this figure from 360 degrees and yet come up with exactly what he wants to present in tempera on the panel.
Peter.
Yeah. So amen to yours, Elliot. And back to Chris's observation that Andy was a storyteller. I mean, he painted what he knew and what he loved. And I think, I'm not sure that in this film there is the final tempera of goodbye, but there is, I think, one study for it. Mm-hmm. So it's the last painting Andy ever did, and it was the last day I saw him alive was the day that he finished that painting. It was the first time Betsy saw the painting. It was October 15th, 1998. And in it, I mean, he's painting his imminent death and a monument to Betsy.
What is the name of the painting?
Goodbye, My Love. We all shorten it to goodbye. But he finished it that day, and in it, there's a small friendship sloop about to come about, come off the port, and sail off the edge of that tempera. The bowsprit is just a fraction of an inch from the edge of the tempera panel. And Andy always painted death in a high key. It was always white for death, not black. So there's Andy about to go. He's about to check out, and this shining white monument to Betsy.
Yeah, that's the sail loft building.
The sail loft on Allen Island. With Andy's, the wake, if you will, the slow, gentle, quiet wake of the friendship, you know, cutting through the reflection of Betsy's monument. It's all about their entire life together. He went out with this grand slam, bases loaded, monumental painting. He was dead 3 months later.
It was just like Andrew. He had this puckish sense of humor. Whether or not he was anticipating his own passing is impossible to say, but it's just like him to throw a wake into the image of his wife's masterpiece, which was that building that he put on Allen Island.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful painting.
Oh, it's a great, it reduced me. It still does.
So many wonderful comments on email and Twitter and calls that we're not going to be able to get to, but I'll read this one from Lynn. After 30 years of seeing my sister's print of Christina's World, I found I was blown away in 2014 during a visit to the National Gallery in Washington when I rounded a corner and found myself face to face with Weatherside. I think I spent most of the morning looking at it. Occasionally, I'd move off to see other paintings, but I kept coming back to it. It's so bony and spare, so Wyeth, and just so Maine, right down to the cloth stuffed into the broken window pane. And I just think that's, you all are all nodding. We've all had that experience of coming around a corner and coming face to face.
That's the Olsen house, the side of the house that where he painted for 30 years. That was basically his main studio for much of his time in Maine.
Well, thank you all for being here.
Thank you. Time seems
so short
can't
today.
I can't believe this is it.
I know. You heard from Elliot Bostwick Davis, chair of the Americas Department of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, Chris Crossman, a trustee of the Wyeth Foundation for American Art and former director of the Farnsworth Museum, and Peter Ralston, a photographer and Wyeth family friend. The American Masters film about Andrew Wyeth will air tonight at 10 on Maine Public Television. Sandra Harris ran the board today. You can find past editions of the program and a lot more at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling's theme was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.